On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, we learn what's new with credit scoring, as well as what's old but still widely misunderstood. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Jay Frosting. Today I'm joined by John Alzheimer, who is the president of consumer education for smartcredit.com, and he writes for mint.com and Credit Sesame. Perhaps more importantly, he used to work for Equifax and Fair Isaac, creators of the FICO score. John, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've written a lot over the years about credit at our website, but there are still a lot of misconceptions. For example, credit scores are used by employers to determine who to hire. Could you educate our audience about the truth of that matter and maybe some other misconceptions that have been frustrating you lately?
Sure, absolutely. The credit score is an employment myth. Is I actually dubbed that the myth of the decade in 2009, and it fails to disappoint. It is by far the most prevalent myth with respect to credit scoring ever, and there really is no close second place. The issue isn't necessarily so much the credit score, it's really the credit report. And too many people, including legislators and people from the media who talk about this all the time, are confusing credit reports and credit scores. Federal law and most state laws still allow for pretty liberal use of credit reports to be used by employers as part of their pre-employment and continued employment screening. The assumption, however, is that because they're getting a credit report, that they're also getting a credit score, which is absolutely incorrect. In fact, it's so incorrect that Equifax, Experian, TransUnion, and their trade association, the Consumer Data Industry Association, have all gone on record a number of times and have dispelled the myth by basically saying, we do not sell credit scores along with the credit reports that we sell for employment screening. Another thing to consider, employers do not get the same type of credit report that a lender or an insurance company would get. The credit reporting agencies know when a request is coming in for a credit report to be used for employment versus a credit report to be used to, say, for example, underwrite a credit card or an auto loan. And they can restrict the information that is delivered with any of the different types of credit reports that they sell and provide. And so what they will do is they will withhold the credit score from the employment reports and then, of course, allow the credit score to be delivered with those that are used for lending and underwriting purposes.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure that I knew that. So there's at least three kinds of credit reports, one that's shown to potential lenders, one that's shown to potential employers, and then the one that I would get by typing in my own information. Are there other types that are out there, and what are some of the differences?
Yeah, definitely. There's a credit report that is used for the underwriting of an insurance policy, and those do not contain the same type of information that a credit report used for mortgage lending or one that is sold to you on the internet, frankly, contains. Don't get me wrong, they're not completely wildly different. They are heavily redundant, but there are some differences. A great example is that restriction of the score for employment reports. When a lender pulls a credit report, they're going to see a full 24 months of your inquiries, which are essentially a record of who pulls your credit report and on what date. However, you may not see a full 24-month history of inquiries when you go online and either buy your credit report or claim your free credit report at someplace like annualcreditreport.com. So while it's heavily redundant, it's definitely not identical.
And it sounds like, just to set the matter to rest, potential employers are absolutely unable to get your credit score from any of the agencies that produce a credit score.
That's exactly right. And the only credit reports really only come from three locations. The repository is where the data resides. So it's Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. Then you have a small army of companies that will buy their data and then turn around and resell it. And those are what are referred to as credit report brokers. And in the world of employment screening, most of the time, the employer or prospective employer is going to buy a credit report from one of those brokers because a lot of those brokers provide other types of employment background screening services, such as verifying your work history, verifying your educational history, verifying your criminal history. The credit reporting agencies don't do those things, and employers do like to see kind of a full view of their prospective employee, which is why you are not generally buying a credit report directly from a bureau for employment. You're buying it from someone else. And look, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, and look, I realize and stipulate and acknowledge that the use of a credit report for employment screening is incredibly offensive to consumers. But if you think about it from a different perspective, it's not the most, in my mind anyways, it's not the most invasive thing that you go through when you're applying for a job. Sometimes you have to go to the bathroom in a cup. Sometimes you have to take these personality tests like Myers-Briggs and DISC profile. And if you think credit scoring is complicated, wait till you try to figure out how those things work.
Yeah.
And so simply having a credit report reviewed, especially if you've got good credit, is actually something that I would love to have happen for me, because I want to show my employer, look how responsible I am. Hire me over the other 10 people who are trying to apply for that job.
Sure. I applied for a job once and they gave us a personality test. Part of it concerned some crude drawings, and they, we were asked to say whether we felt good or bad about them. And one of them was a picture of the devil, and one of them was a picture of a person kicking a dog.
Wow. Wow.
It was pretty easy to figure out how they wanted me to answer those.
Well, it depends on the type of job you're applying for.
I suppose that's true. I see on Twitter here that you just spent a number of days at a credit repair trade show. What were people talking about? What's new in the industry, and what has stuck around as a proven method of repairing credit?
Yeah, credit repair is not a new industry, despite what some people believe. Credit repair, actually, when I started at Equifax in 1991, 21 years ago, credit repair companies were already on the map. So credit repair has been around for at least two decades, if not much longer. And what a credit repair company does is essentially they attempt to get information, most of the time negative information, removed from a consumer's credit report. And so they'll act as the consumer's proxy when disputing information with the credit reporting agencies, and they'll charge a fee for the service. And normally it's a subscription fee, meaning that you'll get billed or they'll hit your credit card for some amount of money every single month for the services rendered during the previous 30 days. Credit repair, there's really no two ways about it. Credit repair has a terrible, terrible reputation. Warranted or not, they've got a very bad reputation. The FTC is very overt in their opinion about credit repair. They think that credit repair is a scam, and they believe that credit repair operators are con artists. And I'm pulling these quotes directly off their website, so this isn't anecdotal. The credit reporting agencies are also very steadfast in their suggesting that credit repair is a scam, and that the consumer can do anything that a credit repair company can do for free. These things may be true, and in the old days, when I was starting in the business, credit repair was a mess. It was the wild, wild west. There really was no federal guidelines and certainly no federal statutes that defined how a credit repair organization had to do business. And because of that, it was loaded with scam artists. In 1996, a federal law was enacted called the Credit Repair Organizations Act, or CROA. That's the acronym for the Credit Repair Organizations Act. And that really was step one in cleaning up what was an otherwise pretty nasty industry. And it defined how you had to make overt disclosures to the potential customer about their rights and how they're able to do these things themselves for free, and that they cannot get items that are accurate off credit reports, and if the consumer wants to cancel, they have to let them cancel immediately, and that you cannot pre-bill them for services. You can only bill them after services have been completely rendered. And so it really did a good job of protecting consumers from the nefarious credit repair agencies. A lot of them, by the way, who are out of business because they've become Federal Trade Commission roadkill. In today's environment, when you're talking about credit repair, it's absolutely a very, very different environment. There are trade associations that represent credit repair organizations that lobby in Washington. There are essentially what I would refer to as industry spokespeople who are very eloquent and seem to be looking out for consumers. However, having said that, there are still some that push the envelope and give the industry a fairly black eye. the purported strategy of a credit repair organization is that they're just going to dispute everything on the credit report that is negative and hope that the credit reporting agencies cannot verify it within the requisite 30 days per the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and then they will have to delete it. That is primarily true. That is basically the strategy. That's not the only strategy. I heard over the past few days a variety of other strategies that had absolutely nothing to do with disputing negative information, but more so forcing the furnisher of the information to validate that the item is actually true and verifiable, which, by the way, is also a right that we enjoy under federal law. It can be correct or incorrect, but if the bank or the collection agency doesn't have a record of it or can no longer confirm it, then it has to be removed. And that's fairly common when you have a bank that has been acquired by another bank, which has then been acquired by another bank. All of those previous records of relationships may not necessarily be accessible any longer, and it's actually not that hard to get those types of items off of credit reports perfectly legally because they're not verifiable.
Yeah, that was the problem I had for a good 7 or 8 years. I had it was a small dollar amount, but it was a black mark on my record for a long time because I couldn't get them to take it off. They conveniently lost 9 months worth of customer data for me when Bell Atlantic became Verizon Wireless. But at the time, I spent many hours on the phone, but I couldn't get them to see my side of things.
And that is the argument for hiring a credit repair company, is that you have better things to do with your time, and that's not one of them. Yeah. That's the argument. The counter argument is, look, it takes 5 seconds to file a dispute online. It costs you, the cost of a stamp, an envelope, and a piece of paper to craft a letter and mail it to the credit bureaus disputing something. And look, both sides have a valid argument, and I don't have a dog in the fight, so I don't care either way. Both sides definitely have an argument. And I've heard the president of one of the credit repair trade associations make a pretty decent comparison to taxes. If you have a 1040EZ return, go ahead and do it yourself. You don't need to pay someone to do it. But the minute you have to start itemizing, then it's going to get far more complicated, and then you may want to enlist the services of an accountant. It's the same thing with credit repair. If you have one item on your credit report that you know is incorrect, you have proof that it's incorrect, is it worth paying someone $49 a month to get it off? Maybe not. If you've got a mixed credit report with a father who shares your name, or you're the victim of identity theft, and everything on their credit report that's bad truly is not yours, and you cannot get the bureaus to budge, that may be when you want to hire those guys. And if their services don't work, then the next person you hire is an attorney to force the bureaus or to force the lenders or to force the collection agencies to correct the credit file.
We had an article on our website a while back about agencies determining your creditworthiness based partially on the types of products you buy. Is that still true? Has that been expanding in scope as far as you can tell?
It was true long before your article, right? And it is still true today. That's one of the great mysteries of underwriting that the cardholder is pretty clueless about. They conclude that the lender is just looking at a credit report and a credit score to determine their creditworthiness, and that's primarily true. However, especially for consumers who have what I would consider to be damaged credit or on the fence between good and bad credit, they're definitely on a shorter leash than consumers who have, for example, FICO 800, who are on a very long leash. And consumers who have a shorter leash are definitely managed more aggressively by credit card issuers than consumers who have very good credit. And one of the ways that they manage it more aggressively is to not only track their spending habits, but primarily where they're using their card. What they don't know, for example, if I'm Bank of America and I have and someone is using a Chase credit card to buy tires, I don't know that they've purchased tires, but I do know that I purchased something at a tire shop, and that's really where it ends. And so you can use logistic regression to determine if anything is predictive of elevated credit risk. And so what some of these guys have figured out is that where you're using your card does in fact tell a story about your credit risk. And while you are unlikely to have your card taken away from you simply because you use it at certain types of merchants, it is something that is on their radar. They are watching it. They do understand it. And it can be used later on when it comes time to either reissue the card or determine whether or not to give you a credit line increase. It's absolutely something that's used.
I was scrolling up and down some of the articles you've written, and I saw the phrase scoring buckets, which isn't a thing I think I've seen before. What are scoring buckets?
Within any credit scoring system is actually a series of other credit scoring systems. When we talk, let's talk FICO, since FICO is still the dominant credit score in the marketplace today. You know, what's your FICO score? 780. And that's usually where the discussion ends. The model that's used to generate that 780 is actually a series of 12 models. And each of those models is referred to as either a bucket or a scorecard. And each of those scorecards is designed to evaluate the risk of a homogenous population. For example, someone who has filed bankruptcy, or someone who has only one or two accounts on their credit report, or someone who has a very young credit history. You can't evaluate them all using the same set of rules, because that would not make sense. So people who build credit scoring systems like FICO will essentially slice up the population into as many of these homogenous groups as they can, and then build a scoring model specific on the behaviors of that particular population. What you end up with is what's referred to as a scorecard. And don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. Think of how you score a baseball game or a basketball game, or when you go bowling. Your points or frame, or you know, your points or pins or runs are tallied either by the inning, by the quarter, or by the frame at the very end. All of them are added up, and then you have your final score. It's the same thing with a credit scorecard. How you perform over a variety of characteristics that have to do with payment history, debt, how old your credit report is, the diversity of your credit accounts, and your inquiries or your shopping habits, all of those are graded and you earn points for those categories. But we're all going to earn them a slightly different way, because we're not all the same consumer and we don't all have the same credit report and history to go off of. You don't know what scorecard is being used to score you. And most consumers have no clue that that's how the systems work. And it's actually probably a good idea, because as you probably have already figured out, it's a very, very technical topic. And most consumers still think that employers use credit scores. Mm-hmm. So, you know, baby steps.
You mentioned populations, and I'm curious if people's creditworthiness is scored differently based on like where they live in the country. For example, you know, the Pacific Northwest is famous for being highly caffeinated, whereas, you know, caffeine is generally considered kind of bad for your health. I wonder if it's scored less importantly up there than it would be in other places. That may not be the best example. Maybe you have a better one.
Yeah, I think the question is how do demographics come into play when you're talking about a credit score? When you're talking about a credit bureau-based credit score like FICO, or like the other scores that are just based on credit bureau data, The answer is no. It's only public records, inquiries, and your accounts that are being considered. It's not considering your address, your former address, your date of birth, your social, your name. None of those things are being considered. Having said that, there are different types of scoring systems that will consider items that are not on a credit report. And for example, there is a type of a credit score referred to as an application score. And what will be scored there is information off of your credit application. So that's where you would put things like your employment, how long you've been employed, your other, for example, if you have a checking account, how long you've lived at the same address, your salary, your net worth. These things are not, none of those things are on a credit report. However, you could put them, for example, on a mortgage application. That can be scored. So yes and no, not exactly things like your address and such, but definitely other items that are definitely not on a credit report. Now, you mentioned the heavily caffeinated Pacific Northwest. There is a very, very significant difference between the average credit scores across the country. And I'm in Atlanta, and unfortunately, we are now proudly boasting the second lowest average FICO scores in the country, 661, only higher than Mississippi's 653. In most of the states that are in the Southeast have very, very low FICO scores. Most of the states in the kind of the middle of the country up north have extremely high average FICO scores. South Dakota, 714, North Dakota, 720, Minnesota, 718. The question is, why? It doesn't have anything to do with their address, but it does have to do with things like Midwest values. The amount of credit cards that are being marketed into that area is extremely different than the amount of credit cards that are marketed into the Southeast, the West Coast, the Upper East Coast. And because of that, consumers are carrying different amounts of debt, different types of defaults, different amounts of mortgages and loans. And those are the types of things that can influence a credit score. So it's indirectly attributable to where they live, but not directly, for example, say from a credit report.
That's fascinating. My cynical supposition is that hot and humid weather makes people depressed and they go out and buy things that they don't need.
That's probably not completely wrong. There is no module or academic requirement to study anything that has to do with credit reporting and debt management at any level of academia. High school, college, it's just simply not there. And taking an econ course and learning about the fact that there is something called a credit card is not sufficient to teach someone how to use a credit card. You can certainly blame the fact that we are not taught how to use these things and how to manage debt properly as a reason why so many consumers learn the hard way, which is to miss payments, default on credit cards, end up with collections, and sometimes, unfortunately, at a very young age. And the world of consumer credit is a self-policing environment where the credit bureaus were going to maintain those things for 7 to 10 years. They're going to keep your credit scores low for 7 to 10 years, and lenders are going to avoid giving you the best deals for 7 to 10 years. And so you have a choice as a consumer. You can learn from your mistake and become responsible users of credit, or you can essentially continue to mismanage it and pay more for things that you're going to finance the entire life your entire consumer credit life cycle. Or you can listen to people like Dave Ramsey, who vilify credit cards and terrify people into not using them, and walk around with prepaid debit cards and cash your whole life, which is not necessarily a good way to function either. So, you know, we have choices, and it's voluntary to how we use these things. And if you screw up, it's a 7-year sentence.
You've been asked a lot lately and written about prepaid debit cards. Is that a product with a significant danger? And are they all of a sudden especially popular?
I think I probably have earned the award for the most quoted person in the past 6 months vis-a-vis prepaid debit cards. And I continue to have significant concerns and have been rightly in my mind extremely critical of prepaid debit cards for a couple of reasons. First off, the way they're marketed is at best deceptive and at worst a flat-out lie. The way that they're being marketed suggests two things. A, that they're less expensive than a properly managed checking account, and B, that they will somehow have a positive influence on your credit. Neither of which is true. However, if you do any cursory research into prepaid debit cards, you're going to see things like this is a cheaper alternative than a bank. And some of them are even going so far as to suggesting that your transactions are going to end up on credit reports. By the way, the credit reporting agencies have all said, no, we don't maintain those types of transactions. So the marketing of these cards is problematic because it's just simply not clear.
What are some of the phrases they use in the marketing that makes people misled?
This product is cheaper than a checking account. I mean, they're essentially suggesting that bank fees are going to cost you more than the fees associated with a debit card. And you know what? If you write bad checks all the time, then that's probably right. But that's a very cherry-picked example. If you have an account, a checking account with a credit union, which costs you no dollars a month, and you never ever write a bad check, or you never go below the $0 mark in your checking account balance, then you're never ever going to have a cost involved with that account except for the cost of paper checks every once in a while. And there are banks, I'll give you a great example, USAA, the bank that pretends like they're a credit union, free checking, and you'll have a better time finding the Holy Grail than you will finding a fee structure on their website because they just don't have fees. So it's definitely deceptive to suggest that a prepaid debit card in every scenario is a cheaper alternative than some sort of banking account. The credit reporting and credit improvement issue is one that I take very, very seriously because that's essentially the mold that I've been cut from. And it has been suggested on some of these websites by some of these, you know, B-level celebrities who are out there pushing these things now that if you use these cards, it might end up on your TransUnion credit report and it may end up helping your FICO score And none of that stuff is true, by the way. Prepaid debit card transactions are essentially a gift card transaction with fees. It's a stored value product. It's not an extension of credit. There is no underwriting. There is no credit report that's pulled and reviewed before it's issued. There is no credit reporting. You don't get a statement at the end of the month. There is no interest. There is no grace period. And also, there are very little protections. So the way that these are being marketed is very, very troubling to me. Up until a couple of years ago, most of the companies that issued prepaid cards you'd never heard of. However, today, Chase, American Express, and Regions Bank, they are all issuing prepaid debit cards.
And I imagine they wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't profitable.
Of course not. I mean, look, they're not doing it for altruism, and they're not 501c3. They're doing it because we are – and the momentum of these cards surprises me. It really surprises me. It's like saying, you know, get this. It's fee-laden, and people are still knocking down the doors to get them. The CFPB suggests that $80 billion was loaded on to prepaid cards last year, and like $150 billion is going to be loaded on them over the next couple of years. So they're not going away, and they are absolutely cash cows for the issuers. And it's actually kind of getting sneaky. Here's something that you may not know. There are also states that if you don't overtly ask them for a paper check or direct deposit, will send you your tax refund on a prepaid debit card. There are also USPIRG, Public Interest Research Group, just published a study that identified a troubling issue on college campuses where students are being issued a hybrid student ID / prepaid debit card where their student aid was being loaded. And the list of fees was amazingly long and extremely impressive. And essentially, they set up a minefield that most fees are punitive, which means if you don't pay your bill late or you don't go over the limit, you're never going to pay a fee. You're getting nailed with fees for simply using your card or taking a semester off. You're getting hit with inactivity fees, which is, by the way, illegal for credit card issuers to charge you inactivity fees, but not for prepaid debit card issuers.
Oh, wow.
So they are seeping into areas where, frankly, it would be nice if they were not seeping.
Well, thank you for coming onto our show and helping to get the word out about all of that.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
That was John Alzheimer, who writes about credit frequently at smartcredit.com. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary Podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.